Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is It's Not Just Over There, Countering U.S.-Sponsored Terrorism in the 21st Century. And I'm going to introduce Norm, who is a professor in economics here at the U, who will then introduce our guests.
Well, thanks very much, and welcome. And it's a pleasure to introduce Alan Nairn today. I'm almost afraid to indicate how far back Alan and I have known each other in some ways. I will say that what do you do with somebody who's too smart for high school? You send him to Washington, and then basically he gets involved with Ralph Nader, and then gets into Latin America, and then gets on to the rest of the world, and he shakes things up. And you try to follow him, and it's impossible. But at any rate, I'll leave that for, there's a lot of mystery there. But it's all true. I just would, by way of further introduction, would say, in a witness to U.S.-sponsored horror, the Washington Post noted, as a reporter, he gathered facts in El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, and other countries where amoral regimes have murdered and suppressed their own people and been rewarded by weapons of the succor of economic aid from Washington. Nairn specializes in human rights stories. As valuable as the annual reports of such organizations as Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International may be, they remain abstract compilations of horrors, not muddy boot accounts from third world villages and streets where people chance their lives to practice the simplest of freedoms. Nairn goes further, exposing links between local violence, clubbing Timorese students, death squads in El Salvador, disappearances in Guatemala, to the sanctioning of that violence by successive arms-supplying U.S. administrations. So without further ado, I'll turn this over to Alan.
Thanks, Norm. In this country, I think it's fair to say that just about everyone is against terrorism. George H.W. Bush, Bush Sr., wrote a preface to a joint Pentagon and State Department report in which he defined terrorism. And I agree with his, I think his definition is reasonable. He said it is the use of violence against unarmed people for political purposes. His son, the second President Bush, George W. Bush, went further and added a dimension that I also agree with. The second President Bush said, if you arm a terrorist, you are a terrorist. If you support a terrorist, you are a terrorist. I think he's correct. And in fact, that was not a stray comment. That was what was referred to by commentators as the Bush Doctrine, the George W. Bush Doctrine. They described it as the central idea of his presidency. I wish it had been the central idea of his presidency, because if President George W. Bush had been serious about combating terrorism, he would have done two things. One, refrain from committing it. Two, take action against those who commit it. And those you have in your power, put them on trial, throw the book at them. Punish them to the fullest extent of the law. The U.S., both federally and in every state, prohibits murder. Every country in the world prohibits murder. Every major religion and culture and ethical code makes an anathema of murder. And the definition of murder is remarkably consistent across all those jurisdictions, all those codes and worldviews that in other ways differ substantially. Everyone knows what murder is. In the U.S. legal system, state laws such as New York, where I live, make distinctions among various kinds of murder. First degree, second degree, down to things like criminally negligent homicide. And everyone knows that if you shoot someone in the head, an unarmed person, you shoot them in the head, you're going to jail. It doesn't really matter what your motivation was until the sentencing phase. At sentencing, after the jury has found you guilty of murder, the judge then takes your motivation into account in determining how many years you'll get, or in certain states the jury has a say in that as well. But you're going to do the time. Everyone also knows that in the American system, if you cause the death of another person, even if accidentally, even if you didn't mean to kill them, but because of your action you killed them, there's a very substantial chance that you will face a criminal charge. It may be one of the lesser forms of manslaughter, but there's a very good chance that you will be tried and that you will go to prison, even if it was an accident. So you're driving your car and you accidentally hit someone. You start a fire inadvertently. It leads to someone's house being burned down. You didn't mean to do that, but it happened. You're going to face charges. None of these are controversial ideas. They're part of what makes this and every society livable. The idea that if people cross a certain line, we got to stop them. Everyone agrees on this. Yet, the United States, like everywhere else, has not yet reached the degree of civilization where we are able to actually enforce these murder laws impartially. And I refer here to a special category of murders. Murders that are committed by high officials acting in their official capacity. In the U.S. today, we're very good at holding people to account for murders that take place outside that circle. Even if you're a rich person, even if you're, Michael Bloomberg, Bill Gates, if you go out and shoot someone, you can get great lawyers, but there's a good chance you'll at least be charged and you may even end up in jail. It wasn't always that way. In earlier stages of development, the rich and the powerful could kill with absolute impunity. They could kill their servants if they displeased them. The founding fathers of the United States, many of them had slaves who they would routinely whip and even murder if it displaced them. But we've advanced beyond that point where we reach the point where we're able to see, oh, that's criminal. You can't get away with that, even if you are rich. Today, if a president of the United States murdered their spouse, they would go to jail. They wouldn't be able to get away with that. In an earlier era, kings, rulers did that kind of thing all the time. But at least we've reached the point where it's no longer possible. But we are still fundamentally uncivilized. I think generations from now, when people look back at this era, they will see us as operating before the dawn of civilization, before we are able to enforce the most basic taboo. Because in today's world, and in particular in today's United States, even though a president of the United States or a secretary of defense or a general cannot get away with killing their spouse, they can get away with killing someone else's spouse if that killing is done acting in their official capacity. They can send a drone to another country that kills someone else's spouse. They can have someone on the payroll of the Pentagon or the CIA or the Defense Intelligence Agency who drags someone out of a house, interrogates them with razor blades, and finishes them with a slit to the throat, knowing that this is what the person does, and afterward, instead of punishing them, giving them more money, giving them fresh weapons. And that is not a crime, because the American official did it acting in an official capacity. Years from now, people will look back at astonishment at this fact, that we allowed our rulers to literally get away with murder as long as those murders were committed overseas. Recently, this spring, I was in Guatemala, a country where in 1954 the CIA overthrew a democratically elected president and put the army in power. A country where that army operated as a subcontractor for the U.S. government, and where in 1980, when I first arrived, the army was committing high noon assassinations in the streets. They would issue death lists, illustrated death lists with photos and brief biographies of the targets, and they would say, so-and-so will be executed. People would drag them from their homes at night. The bodies would be left in the streets with their throats slit, or they would be machine gunned in the street. The targets included labor leaders, peasant organizers, nuns, priests, anyone who was perceived to be an enemy of the military in any way, or a critic of the military in any way, or potentially a critic of the military in any way. The Guatemalan army was following a doctrine enunciated by Colonel John Weber, who in earlier years had served as the U.S. military attaché to Guatemala, where he said, and he's told this to Time magazine, that the army has a license to kill guerrillas and potential guerrillas. Who is a potential guerrilla? Well, logically, anyone. Anyone can turn against the government and take up arms against the government. And a potential enemy doesn't have to be an adult. They could be a child. They could be unborn. In 1982, the Guatemalan army, under a general named Rios Montt, went sweeping through the Northwest Highlands, an area of the Mayan people. They went village to village, and I was there at the time, they would go into the villages, bring people into the square, and they would pull out lists, target lists, compiled for them by the GEDOS, the Guatemalan military intelligence. And on these lists were the sorts of people I described, people who were organizers, people who were thinkers, critics. They had been sent to them from the G2 headquarters in Washington, where the CIA had American personnel working side by side with their Guatemalan counterparts. The CIA later built a whole new headquarters for the GEDOS. Those who were on the list would be pulled out of the crowd. The soldiers described to me what they would do next. They would apply an interrogation technique they had learned in their COBRA counterinsurgency course. They would put a lasso around their neck, and they pulled the lasso off and they'd show me how they did it. And then as they were asking them questions, who here is friends with a local priest? Who here criticizes the army? Who here complains about the landowner? And if they didn't get the right answer, they'd put a stick through the knot, tighten the tourniquet tighter, 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 until the person was strangled to death. And this was done in front of their neighbors. They would then move on to the next. They would get the names of some fresh targets. They would pull those people out. Then they would pull out the machetes and start slashing. They made a particular target of the pregnant women who, under the doctrine of going after delincuentes subversivos, subversive delinquents, and potential subversives, they would not just kill the children, often by picking them up by the legs and swinging them against trees, as you would with the same motion that you use to swing a baseball bat, so that the head of the child strikes against the tree. With the women, they would use the machete and slice open her pregnant womb. This was part of a drama, a terrorist drama, you could call it, to send a message. To send a message to everyone else, don't you dare. Village after village after village, 662 villages by the army's own count, were wiped out in this manner. As it was happening, President Reagan personally flew down, embraced Rios Montt, said he was totally dedicated to democracy, said he was getting a bum rap on human rights. I met Rios Montt in the palace and asked him, why are you killing all these civilians? And he said, for each one who was firing, meaning for each armed guerrilla who was risen in rebellion against the government, there are 10 who are working behind them, namely unarmed civilians. So they have to be killed as well. His advisor, Francisco Bianchi, who was sitting next to the general, who was actually a man of American origin. He was a U.S. evangelical who had gone down to work as Rios Montt's top advisor. He said the Indians, or he used the word indios, which in Guatemalan Spanish was a slur, an ethnic slur against the Mayan majority, had sold out to subversion. So therefore, you had to kill Indians. And people would say, oh, you're committing all these massacres. But they were not innocent. They had sold out. Years later, after Rios Montt had been ousted from power, I met him again. And I noted in the discussion with him that he, Rios Montt, was a strong supporter of the death penalty. So I asked him whether he thought that he, General Rios Montt, should be executed because of his own role in the massacres, for his ordering of the massacres. And Rios Montt, who was a very outspoken man, at least at that point in his life, he leapt to his feet and he shouted. He said, yes, put me on trial. Put me against the wall. Put me against the paredón, the wall for execution. And he said, but if you're going to try me, you also have to try the Americans. You also have to try Ronald Reagan. Well, at the time, I didn't make too much of that remark. I thought it was a bluster from Rio Samant. That's the way he talks. It was an interesting admission, but didn't make too much of it. Then earlier this year, to my astonishment, my absolute astonishment, I got this call asking if I would come down to Guatemala to testify in the war crimes trial of General Rio Samant. For 15 years, the survivors of the massacres had been organizing, trying to bring the general to justice. And they'd been thwarted at every turn. It looked, in many ways, like an idealistic, naive, unattainable goal of the kind we're all familiar with in politics. They were stopped here, they were stopped there. It looked like it was going nowhere. But due to a complicated set of circumstances, due to tremendous courage on the part of survivors, due to the fact that some honest people had made their way into the Guatemalan judiciary, and an honest person, Claudia Pasi Pas, had become attorney general, an honest judge named Jasmin Barrios had become a key trial judge, Rio Samant was brought to trial for genocide and crimes against humanity. And a few months later, I had the astonishing experience of standing in a courtroom, where it was actually an auditorium, kind of a school, big school gym type auditorium. The trial had been moved there because so many people were clamoring to get in. And there was Judge Barrios sitting on the dais with two fellow judges. This was a three-judge panel hearing this criminal trial. There was Rio Samant and his former intelligence chief. There were the prosecutors, and under the Guatemalan system, civilians are also allowed to join criminal proceedings as complainants. So you can work alongside the prosecutor if the prosecutor agrees to that. And they were sitting there, and then in the crowd, filling the seats in this auditorium, were survivors of these massacres. Women whose husbands had been strangled by the technique taught in the U.S.-designed counterinsurgency. Men whose wives had been slashed open. People who were young children at the time. And maybe with partially uncomprehending eyes, saw their father and their uncle and their grandma massacred in front of them. And as they sat there, the judge delivered this verdict. Guilty. And read this long, detailed statement describing the crimes and describing why these were a violation of Guatemalan law. How could they not be? How could it not be a murder? How could it not be a crime against humanity when you send your people in to strangle and rape and slash open civilians for the crime of opposition? How could it be otherwise? But here it was being delivered as an official verdict, as the voice of the law in this packed courtroom. And it was an almost indescribable moment, because the Guatemalans had been living this for decades. The agony had started in 1954 with the CIA coup. It had never relented. The Rio Samant massacres of 82 were merely the peak, but this had become life, in particular for the indigenous Mayan population, for people like a friend of mine who disappeared, and later the word came back that they had sliced her hands off. People had been living with this, but they hadn't given up. They hadn't stopped fighting. They hadn't stopped demanding justice. And here was the court saying, guilty, send him off to prison. And he was dragged from that courtroom by the scruff of his neck as people wept. They broke into hymns. It was one of those moments that that transforms ordinary life into something deeper. And I remember standing in the middle of that courtroom and thinking, my God, can I imagine this happening in the United States? Because here was Guatemala, not a rich country. A country whose most idealistic and courageous and brilliant leaders had been slaughtered generation after generation after generation, were the very witnesses in the trial, the very survivors who testified as witnesses in the trial, were doing so under death threat, public death threats, knowing that they themselves could be killed for testifying. Against all those obstacles, here was Guatemalan society bringing this man to justice. And I tried to imagine a similar proceeding in Texas on the matter of Iraq for George W. Bush, where according to a recent public health study, 405,000 civilians were killed as a result of the U.S. invasion. Or in Chicago for the drone attacks by Obama, a trial for Obama in Chicago, where as a recent UN Human Rights Report documented, hundreds upon hundreds of civilians have been killed. Now, the charges, of course, would be different. Rios Montt was convicted of genocide and crimes against humanity in a case against Bush for Iraq. You could imagine a charge like that, but at a minimum, if the prosecution tried to advance a case of second-degree murder, of manslaughter, of criminally negligent homicide, there's no prosecutor in the country who, making a cold-blooded, honest, objective evaluation of the facts, in light of the local law, in light of the definition of terrorism of Bush's father, in light of the definition of terrorism of Bush Jr. himself, who says if you arm a terrorist, you are a terrorist, these could be serious cases. And I tried to imagine that. And I have something of an imagination, but I just couldn't. Because I could see that the United States has not yet reached the level of civilization of Guatemala. The Mayan people who brought that moment to the courtroom, and it was a moment because the case is not over. Afterward, the oligarchy, those who to this day own the plantations and the factories and the banks of Guatemala, stood up and demanded that the verdict be annulled. And there was an attempted annulment by the Constitutional Court, and right now the case is in legal limbo. Nobody knows what's going to happen with it. It's a political battle. But the main blow for justice had already been delivered. It's inconceivable today that we could even think of applying justice like that here, trying to enforce the murder laws here. Why? Why shouldn't we? It's not a matter of the facts. It's not a matter of lack of evidence. It's not a matter of law. U.S. has the murder laws. The U.S. the U.S. is a party to the relevant instruments that make the U.S. agree to submit to the international law, the principles that establish the idea of crimes against humanity, the Nuremberg principles that grew out of the Nuremberg trials that the U.S. ran against the Nazis after World War II. Even on the level of U.S. legislation, the U.S. has laws on its books which makes much of what Washington does day-to-day in foreign policy contrary to U.S. law. There are four statutes on the U.S. books that, if applied, would essentially stop most of what the Pentagon and the State Department are doing overseas. For example, there's the Harkin Amendment, which prohibits the use of the supply of U.S. weapons for aggression. there is the Leahy Amendment, which prohibits U.S. Aid of any kind to military units that have been engaged in atrocities. There is, I'm trying to find the exact citation from the statutes here, just a moment. There is Section 660 of the 1974 Foreign Assistance Act, which prohibits U.S. aid for foreign internal security forces of any kind. There is the prohibition in 22 U.S. Code 2304A, which says that no U.S. military aid can go to a regime that engages in a pattern of gross human rights violations. So you take those statutes, you apply them, you take domestic criminal law, you apply it, you take international law and the Nuremberg statute, the Nuremberg principles, and apply them. And in fact, you would have U.S. officials hauled before tribunals, as the Guatemalans successfully did. If the U.S. were concerned in a serious way about security, security of American citizens, it would try to minimize the possibility of attack. It would try to make it less likely that the U.S. would be attacked from overseas. They say that that is the motivation behind the drone strikes. They say that that is the motivation behind U.S. recent support for the military coup in Egypt, where the military committed massacres of more than 1,000 peaceful protesters who were calling for the reinstatement of the democratically elected President Morsi, who was just toppled by the military. An action by the military that Secretary of State John Kerry described as restoring democracy. That is justified in the name of anti-terrorism. When the U.S. shipped in white phosphorus bombs and cluster bombs to Israel as they were attacking Gaza and killing roughly 900 Gazan civilians for every Israeli who had been killed by rockets launched over from Gaza, that was described as action to protect U.S. security. When the U.S. ships arms to the armed forces of Indonesia, who use them to target and kill civilians in occupied West Papua, who earlier used them to commit a massacre in occupied East Timor, a massacre that I happened to survive, where hundreds of people were slaughtered with American M16s in front of a church cemetery, that is justified in the name of security. When the U.S. over the years has sent in advisors and weapons to the Colombian military, as military-backed paramilitaries in Colombia have conducted the highest rate of assassinations of labor leaders anywhere in the world, that was done in the name of U.S. security. When the U.S. imposed an embargo on Iraq after Gulf War I and before George W. Bush's invasion in 2003, an embargo that resulted in the deaths of anywhere from 400 to 800,000 Iraqi civilians, according to the estimates by the two UN representatives who were sent into Iraq to administer matters pertaining to food and relief, that was described as being done to guard U.S. security. When in Haiti, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency created the FRAP, which operated as a death squad, capturing those who supported the elected and ousted President Aristide, and using machetes and pistols to execute them, with the head of FRAP, Emmanuel Constant, being placed on the CIA payroll, as Constant described to me, and as DIA and CIA personnel confirmed to me, that was described as being done in the name of security. When General Chely Medrano of El Salvador was brought into the Oval Office by President Lyndon Johnson and given a gold medal for exceptionally meritorious service for his work in creating the Salvadoran Death Squad apparatus, an apparatus that continued in operation through the 1980s, and that among its activities included assassinating the Archbishop of San Salvador, as he said Mass, as he was there on the altar saying Mass, a U.S.-trained sniper took him out from the back of the room. That was done in the name of security. When, during the Nixon administration, in East Pakistan, which was in the process of trying to secede, and it later did and became the nation of Bangladesh, when they were invaded by the military forces of the Pakistani dictator at the time, General Zia-ul-Haq, and Henry Kissinger sent a memo to Nixon recommending that the U.S. back Zia militarily as the slaughter was underway, a slaughter that would eventually claim about 2 million victims in East Pakistan, Bangladesh. Nixon ticked off the box on the Kissinger memo, giving his go-ahead, and he wrote a little note in the margin. Nixon wrote to Kissinger saying, just make sure we do this in a way that it doesn't get out too publicly and doesn't cause any embarrassment for General Zia. That was rationalized as an operation in the name of security. When in Indonesia, in 1965, General Suharto seized power, overthrowing the nation's founder, Sukarno, and launched a massacre that killed anywhere from 400,000 to a million Indonesians. And they started the massacre by taking a list of 5,000 names that was provided to them by the CIA, people who were seen as political leaders, and executing them. That was done in the name of security. These are all crimes, of course. And as a moral issue, they must be stopped. And as a legal issue, if we believe in law, the perpetrators ought to be prosecuted. But apart from that, just as a pragmatic issue, if you're concerned about security, if you're concerned about people getting mad at you and attacking you, why do you keep doing this? Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, who was installed by the U.S. and the U.N. and who has been seen in Afghanistan as a tool of the U.S., a few years ago started criticizing Washington because Washington had fallen into a pattern of bombing Afghan wedding parties. In some areas of Afghanistan, at wedding parties, the people would celebrate by, you know, it's kind of a gun culture, like the United States. And they would, you know, pull out their rifles and shoot them into the air in celebration. And in case after case after case, the U.S. would come in from the air and just wipe out these wedding parties. And Karzai started complaining about that. And the U.S. was outraged at his criticism. Tom Brokaw, the famous journalist, said that the problem the U.S. faces is Muslim rage. Well, how would you feel if somebody bombed your wedding party? Would you be delighted? Would you ask for more? Or instead, if someone came around and said, we're going after those guys who bombed your wedding party, are you with us? How would you respond? If you're concerned about security, stop the attacks, stop the provocations. Now, the answer that many American officials would give to this argument would be to say they started it. They started it on 9/11 or whatever. And that's a very arguable point. You could debate that, you could go back and forth, but the debate is irrelevant. If you're concerned about security, it doesn't matter who started it. The matter is your next action going to cause more danger or less? Is your next action going to increase the likelihood that you'll be attacked or decrease the likelihood that you'll be attacked? And if you're concerned about security, you stop giving people reasons to want to attack. The U.S. is not under attack from Canadians. But if we started a drone program that started hitting people in Saskatchewan, hitting people in Quebec, hitting people in the Northwest Territories, how long do you think before some angry Canadians would start coming across the border? Imagine it here. Imagine the U.S. were under occupation by Al-Qaeda, just as Iraq was until recently under occupation by the U.S., just as parts of Afghanistan are still under occupation by the U.S. And Al-Qaeda set up checkpoints. And here, right outside, on the traffic circle, Al-Qaeda set up checkpoints where, you know, you have to drive up, you have to roll down your window, you have to present your papers, they check the trunk, they ask you what's going on. And let's say, and maybe you don't like these Al-Qaeda guys, so you come up to a checkpoint and you don't stop when they tell you to. And the Al-Qaeda guys then open fire on the car, machine gunning, killing everyone inside. That was exactly the U.S. practice in Iraq, where case after case after case, cars that didn't stop fast enough at checkpoints were machine gunned. And imagine if under this Al-Qaeda occupation of the U.S., Al-Qaeda announced that they were going after American officials who had been engaged in military action against them. So when in the suburbs of Washington, one afternoon in McLean, Virginia, some guy who works at the Department of Defense is having a barbecue with his family, and the clouds part, and out of the sky comes an Al-Qaeda drone, blowing him to kingdom come. And on DuPont Circle, as someone from the White House goes out for coffee, they are obliterated by a drone. And, of course, taking out all those in a 20-meter radius, regardless of who they are. And what if Al-Qaeda, in their occupation of the U.S., adopted a policy of signature strikes, where they didn't necessarily have to know who they were bombing? They wouldn't have to know if the person who's walking outside the student center here at the university, they wouldn't necessarily have to know their name. They wouldn't necessarily have to know their biography. All they would have to know is that they were an American male, maybe an American Christian male or an American Mormon male of military age. A number of you guys in the room, I believe, would fit that description, especially if they were gathered in a group. So Al-Qaeda intelligence back over in Pakistan or wherever, through their technology, they see on their screen, aha, in Salt Lake City, there's a group of a dozen males of military age gathered outside the student center. Strike. A drone comes in, obliterates them. Signature strike. Precisely the U.S. Drone policy today under Obama. Or the double tap. What the double tap says is after this strike takes out the crowd of young men outside the student center, and the first responders come running. Someone from the a medic comes running. An ambulance pulls up. Someone who's in a dorm and hears the bomb and says, oh my God, that was my brother over there by the student center where that explosion went off. I got to run over and see what happened. As they all run to the scene, drone number two comes in. Number two of double tap takes them all out. Also a part of official, on the record, current U.S. policy regarding when drone strikes are justified. How would we feel about that? Further, how would we feel if some young American, some young Utah resident, some young student of the U, decided they were going to go out and kill one of those Al-Qaeda occupiers because he heard what happened outside the student center. How would we regard that young person? You know how we'd regard him. They'd be a hero. It's not so hard to understand once you think about it in, you know, once you attempt to make a fairly even-handed assessment of it. Just imagine the shoe being on the other foot, which is, you know, one of the simplest common sense methods you can use for analyzing any situation. You're creating enemies, you're creating hatred by the moment, by the day. But even if you weren't, I would say this, I would go beyond this. Even if you weren't, even if you pulled back, you would still have to stop it. You would still have to stop these attacks, refrain from committing these attacks. Because although it's good to stop Americans from being killed, that's good, people are people. One American is not more valuable than one Pakistani or one Guatemalan or one Haitian. In the eyes, as some people would say, in the eyes of God, they have equal value. As others would say, they have the same soul inside them. If you take that perspective, the perspective of all world religions, the perspective of all world legal systems, then you would have to say that the goal should be defined as minimizing killing of innocents overall, not just of Americans, but overall. If that is the case, then the case becomes even stronger for saying that the U.S. must stop such attacks, must stop, as George W. Bush would say, being a terrorist by arming a terrorist, like the armed forces people of Guatemala, like the armed forces people of Indonesia, like the armed forces of Egypt, like the armed forces of Israel, like the interrogators of the Palestinian Authority, like the armed forces of Colombia, like the FRAP of Haiti, and on and on and on. Because if you actually do the body count, if you actually pile the bodies and see how high they are, the Americans who've died as a result of this approach, the American soldiers who've given their lives in combat overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, the American civilians who've been killed in terrorist attacks like 9/11 and elsewhere, those Americans are less than 1% of the overall death toll. It's the foreigners who overwhelmingly do the dying, often directly at the hands of the U.S., or even more so at the hands of U.S.-sponsored forces. And if you apply the human test, the religious test, the legal test, the ethical test, you have to say, well, that's the number one priority, to minimize the overall number of killings of innocents. And that leads you to the same conclusion that the security criterion, that the security standard leads you to, and that is stop. Follow the law. Stop violating local murder laws. Stop violating international prohibitions on crimes against humanity. Start complying with the U.S. statutes on the books, the Harkin Amendment, the Leahy Amendment, the Foreign Assistance Act, the Foreign Assistance Act, the relevant sections of the U.S. Code. And by doing that, one, you achieve the most important goal of minimizing the overall killing, because in this historical moment today, in today's world, it's been different in earlier epochs, but today it's the U.S. that is behind the largest amount of killings of civilians around the world. One, you minimize that. And two, you get the added side benefit of increasing your own security, because you're not provoking so many people into rage against you, because you've nuked them outside their equivalent of the student center, or their loved one, or because you bombed their wedding party. Now, calling for something like this might sound naive. It might sound unrealistic. But I don't think it's quite as naive and unrealistic as it would have been 15 years ago in Guatemala to call for General Rios Montt to be hauled into a courtroom and to sit there as the judge hands down a sentence. That was more far-fetched. Because in Guatemala, at that moment, if you dared to call for such a thing, you put your life at risk. You faced a system which did not have anything like an open flow of information. You faced a system in which there was no real democratic representation that you could use. You faced a legal system which was just riddled from top to bottom with corruptions, with people who were agents of the army, with people who were not professional, with people who did not follow the law. It seemed like a very unrealistic project. Yet survivors decided they had to do that, and they did it, and they succeeded. I think we should try to catch up with Guatemala. I think we should try to stop committing murder, stop committing terrorism as defined by President Bush Sr., stop arming terrorists and therefore becoming a terrorist, as President Bush Jr. Put it. And here, if we work for that, you don't face the prospect of being snatched in the night and having your hands cut off, as they did to my friend. Or you don't face the prospect of being found in a ravine with your hands bound behind your back and multiple stab wounds across your torso and your face sliced away, as happened to Jafar Siddiq Hamza, another friend of mine from Aceh in Indonesia. And there were four other bodies found with him in the same condition, but we could never identify the other four. Only was able to identify Jafar because he'd had an operation on his intestines, and in the autopsy that made it possible to say, oh, that's Jafar. Those other four people remain anonymous to this day. We don't face that here in the United States. We can stop it. We ought to stop it. And that, what I've been talking about now, is only the beginning of the problem. I'm talking about direct murder, direct terrorism. The bigger problem is preventable death. The billion people roughly per year in the world who die because of hunger and the consequences of hunger, who could be fed in the short term by roughly the same amount of money that it took to bail out Citibank after the 08 financial crisis, but who aren't because a policy choice is made. I shall talk about that tomorrow in the at the economics department. It's at 1:30. There'll be a session talking about the economic aspects of this, and particularly the economics that poor people face when you're living on the edge. It's possible, it's necessary, and we ought to do it. So, thank you.